All right, I'd like to pick up where we left off in the book of Samuel, and I know that a number of people weren't here when we started this book of Samuel, but just really, real brief recap, and we go through that Samuel, we're not sure, for positive sure anyway, who wrote the book of Samuel, but it's Jewish Talmud says that Samuel did write it, and obviously he didn't write the whole thing because it even records his death, but according to 1 Chronicles 29, a prophet by the name of Nathan and Gad, and perhaps the priest Abiathar had also written this book. And it was written around 1,000 years before Christ. And, you know, it really has a great deal, I think, to say to us in terms of, you know, a lot of the spiritual illustrations or examples that can be gleaned from this. Because when we're going through this, I think there's so much in it, like Paul says in the New Testament, that it's given to us for our instruction, for our edification, for our reproof, for our understanding, for our example. And I tell you, when you go through this book of Samuel, there's so much spiritual, I think, insights that we can glean from the stories that are brought forth here. But anyway, let's just pick up with where we left off. We left off in chapter 3. And for those of you who weren't here when we went through this chapter 1 and 2, just briefly, it was dealing with the birth of Samuel, and he had basically a miraculous birth in the sense that his mother Hannah had really prayed earnestly for him, and then because God had answered her prayer, she dedicated him in lifelong service to God. So she left him there with Eli, the high priest, as well as Eli's sons, and he was being raised basically in a tabernacle and to serve God. So this is where we pick up in this chapter 3. And it says, "Now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord before Eli. And the word of the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were infrequent. And it happened at that time as Eli was lying down in his place. Now his eyesight had begun to grow dim and he could not see well. And the lamp of God had not yet gone out. And Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was. That the Lord called Samuel, and he said, 'Here I am.' Then he ran to Eli and said, 'Here I am, for you called me.' But he said, 'I did not call. Lie down again.' So he went and lay down. And the Lord called yet again, 'Samuel.' So Samuel arose and went to Eli and said, 'Here I am, for you called me.' But he said, 'I did not call, my son. Lie down again.' Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, nor had the word of the Lord yet been revealed to him. So the Lord called Samuel again for the third time, and he arose and went to Eli and said, 'Here I am, for you called me.' Then Eli discerned that the Lord was calling the boy. And Eli said to Samuel, 'Go lie down, and it shall be, if he calls you, that you shall say, "Speak, Lord, for thy servant is listening."' So Samuel went and lay down in his place. Then the Lord came and stood and called as other times, 'Samuel, Samuel.' And Samuel said, 'Speak, for thy servant is listening.' And the Lord said to Samuel, 'Behold, I am about to do a thing in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears will tingle. And that day I will carry out against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told them that I am about to judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse on themselves, and he did not rebuke them. And therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever.' So Samuel lay down until morning. Then he opened the doors of the house of the Lord, but Samuel was afraid to tell the vision to Eli. And Eli called Samuel and said, 'Samuel, my son.' And he said, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'What is the word that he spoke to you? Please do not hide it from me. May God do so to you and more if you hide anything from me of all the words that he spoke to you.' So Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him. And he said, 'It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him.' Thus Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fail. And all Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh, because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord." Now, you know, the reason I read this whole thing is because you don't want to break up this theme of this story, but I think it's really, really instructive, because here's Samuel. He's a young kid. We don't know exactly how old he is at this particular time, but Josephus says he's about 12 years old. So don't get this mental picture that he's only about 5 or 6 or 7 or 8. I think he's a little older. He's just reaching a puberty, and he's there sleeping in the temple. Well, actually, it's a tabernacle, but it says temple here, but it's basically the same thing, the same concept. And I don't know how this worked, because the priest had access, obviously, to the tabernacle. But when you read all the writings of Moses in the book of Exodus, when we put together the tabernacle, there was no really sleeping quarters within the sanctuary. But apparently at this particular time, the priests themselves slept in this tent right there with the Lord. I guess they had different compartments. I know that when Solomon built the temple, you know, they had the main sanctuary, and then off to the sides they had separate rooms for storage rooms and even for rooms for the priests to stay and things like that. So I don't know exactly what this looked like, but from just reading this, it sounds like Samuel was sleeping within the sanctuary. It'd be like somebody sleeping in the church. Okay, but interesting thing, it says that at this particular time he didn't know the Lord. All right, and I think that says a lot, because if you look down there, he says, back up there, verse 2, and it says, "And it happened about that time that Eli was lying down in his place. Now his eyesight had begun to grow dim, and he could not see well, and the lamp of God had not yet gone out. And Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was, that the Lord called to Samuel, and he said, 'Here I am.' Then he ran to Eli and said, 'Here I am, for you called me, but I did not call you, lie down again.'" But what's kind of interesting to me is that here's a situation where it says that just before the lamp of the Lord went out, in that verse 2, it talks about Eli's eyesight, because we know from the next chapter that Eli's in his 90s at this particular time. And it says that in verse 3, the lamp of God had not yet gone out. And that says a lot to me, I think, because you could see that these people were living in a day and age, which refers to as Israel's dark ages. I mean, everybody was doing what was right in their own sight. And because of spiritual adultery and apostasy and immorality and ungodliness, I mean, the lamp was beginning to grow dimmer and dimmer. And Eli is about to meet his death along with his sons, and so that's when the lamp of God is going to go out on Israel. And I think it's kind of suggestive to us, or at least it's I think instructive to us, when we look at the situation where Jesus said in John chapter 8, he said, "I'm the light of the world," okay, and he basically said that the night is coming when no man can work. And he also referred to his followers as being the light of the world. And you look at the darkness that is engulfing our world today and engulfing our nation today. I'm talking about the spiritual darkness. I'm talking about looking around and just seeing that the love of many is growing cold as far as God is concerned, and wickedness is beginning to abound to the point where it's just epidemic everywhere we look. And I'm seeing the light of the world going out. And once it goes out, judgment falls. And that's what we're going to see here in a minute. But it does say that at this particular time that Samuel didn't know the Lord, and God had not spoken to him before this time. And I think that's kind of instructive, because even though Samuel is raised in this very religious setting, he still has to come to a saving knowledge of God himself. I mean, it's not enough to be able to be just born and raised into a religious family, or even if your father's a pastor or a minister, or if your mother sings in a choir or teaches Sunday school, you still need to come to a saving knowledge of God on a one-on-one basis. And even though Samuel was right there living in the very presence of God, he didn't know him until he has this experience where God begins to call out his name. And, of course, when he calls out his name, he just assumes it's Eli, because Eli being an old man, about half blind, I guess Eli really depends upon him. So Samuel just jumps up every time he hears Eli call his voice, but he's mistaking it for Eli when it's God speaking to him. And I think that's kind of significant, because four different times he ends up calling him, and it's not till the fourth time that he responds saying, "Speak, Lord, your servant is listening." He probably would have been calling Samuel all night if Eli hadn't discerned that it was the Lord that was calling him. And that, to me, is kind of significant, because God can be calling us in different ways, and we can always end up misinterpreting who it is. I mean, it happens all the time, doesn't it? It really does. I mean, you know, if you go back to 1 Kings in chapter 19, we read about Elijah. Remember when Elijah was running from Jezebel for his life, and he finally ends up in a cave having gone to Mount Horeb to escape this woman. And it's interesting what God says to him, because God says this to him when Elijah came there. It says, "Then he came to a cave and lodged there, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?' And he says, 'I have been very zealous for the Lord the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken thy covenant and tore down thy altars and killed thy prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. And he said, go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord, and behold, the Lord was passing by, and a great strong wind was rending the mountain and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind, and after the wind an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake, and after the earthquake a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire, and after the fire a sound of a gentle blowing, or basically a whisper. And it came about when Elijah heard it that he wrapped his face in his mantle, and he went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, a voice came to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? And he said, I have been very zealous for the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken thy covenant and tore down thy altars and killed thy prophets with the sword, and I alone am left. And anyway, God basically, you know, reaffirms him and tells him what he needs to do to go back and to anoint various people and to keep up the good fight. But here's the thing. Look at the way God dealt with him in a situation. First of all, he was at that mountain, and God asked him, what are you doing here? And he says, go stand at the entrance of the cave. And what happened there? There was a great wind that came by, and it was renting the rocks, and they were flying all apart. And it says the Lord wasn't in the wind. And it says then a big, huge earthquake shook the whole mountain, and everything was just shaking. And it says the Lord wasn't in the earthquake. And then it says a fire just rent the whole mountain, and the Lord wasn't in the fire. But what was the Lord in? In a still, small, gentle voice. It was a whisper. And then, you know, Elijah knew it was the Lord. So he put his mantle around his face, or his shawl, whatever it was, and he walks out and speaks to God, or God speaks to him. Isn't that instructive? Or isn't that significant? I mean, it is to me that a lot of times we may think that God does things, you know, that God is only in something that's very, very, I guess, earth-shattering. But a lot of times he may be speaking to us with a still small voice. And like Samuel, we might not be able to recognize that it's him speaking to us. And then other times, I think God speaks loud and clear, and yet people are just deaf to it. You know, they don't attribute it to being God. I mean, in my opinion, I say this over and over again, but I look at 9/11, I think that was the voice of God. I think it was a warning from heaven. There's no doubt in my mind that it was, all right, warning this nation that if we don't turn from our wicked ways, this is only the beginning. This is only the beginning of things. I think we, Kevin and I were talking about this last week. I think we were talking about how 9/11 was basically the Titanic hitting the iceberg. And we are on our way down. And the irony is that look at the, you know, everybody aboard this ship. I mean, it seems like it's just almost laughable if it wasn't so tragic when you see, let's say, for example, all these politicians now are gearing up for the 2008 presidential election. And they remind me of just a bunch of fools just playing musical chairs on the top deck of the Titanic, saying, who's going to become the captain here? When don't you realize we're on our way down because God has spoken loud and clear that unless we change our ways, things are really going to get bad? Well, like I said, I didn't want to get off on a tangent there, but you look at the way Samuel, he didn't discern it was God, all right, until the fourth time. And he, and what does God say to him? I think it's very, very important or very instructive, because when God does speak to him, in verse 10 it says, then the Lord came and stood and called out as other times, Samuel, Samuel, and Samuel said, speak, for thy servant is listening. And the Lord said, behold, I am about to do a thing in Israel, which both ears of everyone who hears will tingle. And that day I will carry out against Eli and all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. Now, we read, of course, most of you guys weren't here the other night, but we read about how God sent a prophet to Eli. Okay? And he warned Eli that because of the wickedness of his sons, and his sons were priests, but they were just showing such disrespect and such contempt and such irreverence towards the sacrifices, which all pointed to Jesus Christ, that God said he's going to punish them and punish that whole household. And, you know, God basically rebuked Eli for putting his own sons above him because he didn't rebuke them for their sacrilegious behavior. And so he's going to bring a tremendous judgment upon his whole household. Look at verse 13. For I have told them that I am about to judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse upon themselves, and he did not rebuke them. Now, that's pretty instructive. And I was just sharing the other night that, you know, where it says in Proverbs 13, where Solomon said, he who withholds his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him diligently. And also in Proverbs 19:18, it says, discipline your son while there is hope, and do not desire his death. In other words, if you don't discipline your children, don't discipline your son, he can die an early death. And what do we got now? 3 weeks ago, you read in the paper about this congresswoman who now wants to make it a criminal offense to spank your children? I mean, this is where we are at today. And God says very plainly, hey, man, discipline your children diligently. You know, it'll keep them out of jail. It'll keep them out of prison. It'll keep them from dying prematurely. It'll keep them out of hell. You know what I'm saying? But look at that. These fuzzy thinkers, these shallow thinkers come along and say, no, you know, we're going to make it a crime to spank your children. Isn't it something? And then we read here that because Eli put his own sons above God by not disciplining them, all right, that he's going to bring a judgment upon his whole household. And remember what Jesus said, and I think it was in Luke 14. He said, unless you hate your mother and your father and your brothers and your sisters and even yourself, you can't be my disciple, meaning that, hey, we can't put anyone above Christ. All right, we're to love our mother and our father and our brothers and sisters and our children and everyone else, but if we can't put them above God, if we put them above God, you know, it's only going to bring judgment upon ourselves, just exactly what Eli did. Because in verse 14 it says, and therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever. And to me, what that sounds like very clearly to me is blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. And you see that. You see that. I think it's in the sixth chapter of Hebrews, and even Jesus talked about, you know, the blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. That every sin that men will commit against the Son and against the Father can be forgiven. But if you blaspheme the Holy Spirit, that'll never be forgiven. And blasphemy of the Holy Spirit is basically sinning against the light that you clearly see, and you're just going to sin against it anyway with a high hand. And that's exactly what these guys did, and they brought a tremendous judgment upon them. So anyway, Samuel lies down after he hears this pronouncement of judgment. And then he goes and he opens up the house of God. But look what's interesting to me is that Eli comes to him, and this is what Eli says to him in verse 16. And Eli called Samuel and said, Samuel, my son. And he said, here I am. He says, what is the word that he spoke to you? And now he says this. He says, please do not hide it from me. May God do so to you and more also if you hide anything from me of all the words that he spoke to you. Now, the guy just knows because of his own failures, he knows that whatever God says to Samuel, it can't be good. If he didn't have a guilty conscience, he would have been curious to know, okay, what did the Lord say? All right, but he goes further and says, tell me what the Lord says, and if you don't tell me everything he says, may he do to you even worse. You see what I'm saying? That's what he's saying here. So the suggestion is he knows it can't be good because he's been warned and warned and warned, and he's done nothing about it. And now what happens to him? It's almost like he's at the point of no return. Now, I think what's also is that Samuel didn't hide anything from him. Now, what I see in this is that this was Samuel's first test. You know what I mean? It was like, okay, God told Samuel some very unpleasant news. And Samuel, you know, loved the old man, and he didn't want to tell him. He just didn't want to tell him this, right? But, okay, he knows that he's got to tell the truth, and he's got to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth, and so he does, right? That's his first test. See, what I'm driving at here is, look at how many pastors, ministers, priests, or people in spiritual authority, or teachers, or whoever today, they will skip over, they will ignore, and they will even at times deny the unpleasant things of the Bible. And I've said this many times. I mean, to me, it's conspicuous by its absence. I mean, when's the last time you heard a sermon on hell? When's the last time you heard a sermon on sin and judgment and accountability and these kind of things? Well, you know what? A lot of pastors and ministers and priests today, they don't want to give us the whole story because they don't want to offend anybody. But I really think that, hey, we need to give out the full counsel of God. Otherwise, I think you bring judgment upon those who you're teaching or preaching to, and as well as yourself, because it's not the full message of God. And this was Samuel's first test. His first test, and he's a young boy now, probably about 12 years old. He doesn't want to tell the old man this. This is nothing but bad news, but he tells him anyway. And as a result, he confirms himself as being a prophet. And I think it says a lot. I think a lot of ministers and pastors and priests today could learn from this and say, hey, man, we need to speak the whole counsel of God and not just edit it out or not just skim over or skip over or ignore the parts that are unpleasant. And that's what's happening all over the church today. And anyway, what's interesting, too, is that in verse 19 it says, thus Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fail. And all of Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared to him at Shiloh because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. Now, it says in that verse 19, and Samuel grew and the Lord was with him and let none of his words fail. Or none of it, literally none of his words fall to the ground. In other words, everything that Samuel predicted came to pass. Everything. All right, he was confirmed as a true prophet of God. And his reputation began to precede him. People all over Israel began to recognize that here's a prophet of God because everything he says is coming to pass. Anybody have anyone to add or share to that chapter?
I have two questions.
Yeah.
First one is, what happened to Eli's wife?
It's never mentioned there. She's never mentioned. His wife is never mentioned. All right, so we don't know if she's still alive. She probably isn't, and I just simply say that because we know at this particular time that Eli's in his 90s. So there's a good chance she has passed on.
Well, not at this point, but all the ways he was raising the two kids. Did the wife play a role in...
Oh, I'm sure she did, but let's face it. It's the man who's the spiritual head. It's the man who really has the responsibility and the obligation before God to teach and instruct his children and raise them up in the love and knowledge and fear of God. Now, believe me, that doesn't mean that the wife doesn't have responsibility, all right? But that is the father who really, I think, wields that authority that it can be most effective.
Second question is it because Eli realized that his parenting didn't work the first time, so he tried better, and so Samuel turned out much better, or is it because...
That's a very good question. But first of all, Samuel, if you guys remember from last week, he was raised by his mother, until he was weaned, probably... when he was 3 or 4 years old, all right? His mother took him down to the temple and dedicated him there, and that's where he stayed, all right? He had a godly upbringing by his mother and that constant input from his mother. But here's what I think really happened, because we don't read it. We didn't read it in the first two chapters, and we didn't read it in this third chapter, but we will read it in this next chapter, is that Eli dies at 98, and it says that he fell over backwards because he was heavy. In other words, he was a very fat man. You know what that suggests to me? Is that he was a man who was not in control of his appetites. And consequently, he wasn't in a position to rebuke his sons when they too, by their actions of always taking the choice meat and even what belonged to God, they were gluttonous. So I think he passed this sin on to his sons. And even though we are not told that his sons were heavy or his sons were fat, for the very fact that they constantly disregarded the sacrifices that were being offered to God and they just kept taking portions for themselves, I think suggests very strongly that they were very, very gluttonous men. And they got this from their father. And because their father was that way, he couldn't really rebuke his sons for being that way, because he didn't have a leg to stand on. Now, that's speculative on my part, but you put all this together, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. You see what I'm saying? I mean, if you've got a father that's an alcoholic and then he sees his sons following his footsteps, he doesn't have a leg to stand on by rebuking them, does he? I mean, if the father's a pathological liar and then he catches his sons lying, his rebuke is just going to go one ear and out the other because he doesn't have a leg to stand on. And I think that's exactly what happened with his sons.
Hey, John, you mentioned that Israel's dark ages.
Yeah.
And it says the word... from the Lord was rare in those days,
right?
Tie into that.
Right, yeah. And I think you can see that pretty much today, too. I'm talking about today. I'm talking about in our country. I mean, we are definitely going through a very dark time in our history as far as our morality is concerned. And, you're not seeing a whole lot of the word of the Lord being preached today. Like I said, we're not preaching the whole counsel of God. I think that has something to do with contributing to the darkness that we're in. Anyway, let's pick up on this verse 1 of chapter 4. It says, thus the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to meet the Philistines in battle and camped beside Ebenezer while the Philistines camped in Aphek. And the Philistines drew up in battle array to meet Israel. And when the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the battlefield. And when the people came into the camp, and the elders of Israel said, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us take to ourselves from Shiloh the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, that it may come among us and deliver us from the power of our enemies. So the people sent to Shiloh, and from there they carried the ark of the covenant of the Lord of hosts, who sits above the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the ark of the covenant of God. And it happened, as the ark of the covenant of the Lord came into the camp, that all Israel shouted with a great shout, and the earth resounded. And then the Philistines heard the noise of the shout. They said, "What does the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" And they understood that the ark of the Lord had come into the camp. And the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who shall deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. Take courage and beat men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews, as they have been slaves to you. Therefore, beat men and fight." So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent, and the slaughter was very great, for there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers, and the ark of the God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. Now a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh, and came that day with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And when he came, behold, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road, eagerly watching, because his heart was trembling for the ark of God. So the man came to tell it in the city, and all the city cried out. And when Eli heard the noise of the outcry, he said, "What does the noise of this commotion mean?" Then the man came hurriedly and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were set so that he could not see. And the man said to Eli, "I am the one who came from the battle line. Indeed, I escaped from the battle line today." And he said, "How did things go, my son?" Then the one who brought the news answered and said, "Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has also been a great slaughter among the people, and your two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the ark of God has been taken." And it came about, when he mentioned the ark of God, that Eli fell off the seat backwards beside the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died, for he was very old and heavy. You almost have to underline that he was heavy. Thus he judged Israel 40 years. Now his daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, was pregnant and about to give birth, and when she heard the news that the ark of God was taken and that her father-in-law and her husband had died, she knelt down and gave birth, for her pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the woman who stood by her said to her, "Do not be afraid, for you have given birth to a son." But she did not answer or pay attention, and she called the boy Ichabod, meaning, "The glory has departed from Israel, because the ark of God was taken, and because of her father-in-law and her husband." And she said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God was taken." Now, I read this whole thing, the whole 22 verses here, because, again, it's a story you don't want to break up. You want to get the overview of the theme of what's going on here. And, again, this is very instructive to me. You back up to the first verse, and what is it saying? "Thus the word of Samuel came to all of Israel." Now, Israel went out to meet the Philistines in battle and camped beside Ebenezer, while the Philistines camped at Aphek. And the Philistines drew up in battle array and met Israel. And when the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the battlefield. Now, that's pretty, I think, instructive. Because here's a situation where these are God's people, but they meet a terrible defeat. They lose 4,000 men. Now, just kind of think this through. Look at it from a spiritual perspective. When they lose 4,000 men, what do? It says here in verse 3, "When the people came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, 'Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us take to ourselves from Shiloh the ark of the covenant of God, for it may come among us and deliver us from the power of our enemies.'" Now, this is what they decided to do. They said, okay, they asked a good question. Why have we been defeated? That was their question. Look at that verse 3. "Why has the Lord defeated us today before our enemies?" That's a good question. But instead of seeking the answer, what do? They figure, well, what we got to do is we've got to get God on our side here. So they go to get the ark. And remember the ark, okay, that was that golden box that contained the Ten Commandments and Aaron's rod and the jar of manna. And they had two angels that were looking down upon the mercy seat, the cover of that ark. And that, well, that's where the blood was supposed to be applied. And the angels were looking down, and God was supposed to dwell between these angels, always looking at the blood that was covering, you know, the Ten Commandments that men break, and the jar of manna that represented God's provisions that men scorn and are ungrateful for, and also the authority that they rebel against that God has put over them. Well, I don't care whether it's their parents or their cops or their teachers or whoever. But here's the thing. What do? They recognize that God was not with them in this situation. But they run over there and say, well, what we got to do is we've got to get God on our side. So they grab the ark and they go back into battle. What do you think they should have done?
Should have repented and prayed.
They really should have got to say, hey, you know what? We just lost 4,000 men here. What we really need to do is seek God's face. Because they knew it was God. I mean, look at that verse 3. Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? They knew it was God. But rather than really seeking God diligently in this question, they just figured, well, we got to get God on our side. So they run and grab a piece of furniture and drag it into battle again. You know what? I mean, to me, history repeats itself over and over and over and over again. And I look at, okay, how many people did we lose on 9/11? We lost 3,000. All right? And believe me, the question arose, why has God allowed this to happen? It arose like that all over the country, didn't it? But what did we do? We went right into war without doing what? I mean, God was talking to us loud and clear. You know what you really need to do? Just like it says in Chronicles, chapter 7, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I will heal their land. But instead, they figure, well, let's go get God on our side. But here's what they missed, and here's what we're missing. All right? Remember, we just went through the book of Joshua, and there was an episode there just before they went up against Jericho, to fight against the city of Jericho. It says that Joshua was confronted by a man with a drawn sword, and he discovers that this man is none other than the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. He's a captain of the Lord of hosts. And he says that, Joshua, take off your shoes because you're standing on holy ground. But the first thing Joshua said to him, he says, are you with us or are you against us? Are you for our enemies? That's what Joshua's question was. Before he realized who it was, that's what he asked the Lord of hosts. Well, what did God say to him?
Yeah.
He said neither. He said nay. In other words, people always want to get God on their side. But that's not the way it works. We have to get on his side. People can say, well, is God a Republican or a Democrat? I'm saying he's neither. Is God a Catholic or a Baptist? He's neither. We have to get on his side. You know, but people always figure, well, we need to get him on our side. That's not the way it works. So they go in there, they grab the ark, and they go right back into battle without seeking this thing through. Look what it says here. And verse 4, so the people sent to Shiloh, and from there they carried the ark of the covenant of the Lord of hosts, who sits above the cherubim, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the ark of the covenant of God. And it happened as the ark of the covenant of the Lord came into the camp, and all of Israel shouted with a great shout, so that the earth resounded. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, and they said, what does this noise of this great shout of the camp of the Hebrews mean? And they understood that the ark of the Lord had came into the camp, and the Philistines were afraid, for they said, God has come into the camp. And they said, woe to us, for nothing like this has happened to us before. Now here's the thing. What happened after 9/11? We did see a little bump in church attendance. But what did you see? You see all these politicians standing out there on the steps of the Senate floor, I think, and they were singing God Bless America. And now we got a situation where, you know, everybody's up in arms because they want to take God out of our pledge. And I even got a phone call one time when somebody said they're raising money to make sure that God is kept in our pledge. And I just told the person as politely as I could on the phone, I said, you know what, I'm not giving a dime for that. Not a dime. I says, God doesn't give a hoot whether we keep his name in the pledge or not. What we really need to do is get right with him. And then we won't have a problem with his name in the pledge. But you see what happens to us? We want to keep his name on our dollar bills, and God we trust. We want to keep his name under God in our pledge. But we only honor him with our lips. Our hearts are far from him, just like it says in Isaiah. These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. So it's kind of like, hey, all it's doing to us is just inoculating us with a feel-good feeling. You know, it's just inoculating us with enough, quote-unquote, spirituality or religion to make us comfortable in our sins when we can say, in God we trust in our stinking dollar bills or one nation under God in our Pledge of Allegiance. See, we're not getting to the heart of the problem here. And so when the Philistines hear that God is coming to their camp, it means nothing because God's not with them. So anyway, the Philistines say, woe to us, man, we've had it because look what they did to the Egyptians. And so the Philistines, you know, they worked themselves up. They figured, hey, man, we got to fight to the death and fight like we never fought before because otherwise we're going to become slaves to them. And what happened to them? There's a great slaughter. Look at that verse 10. So the Philistines fought and Israel was defeated and every man fled to his tent and the slaughter was very great for there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. Now, day before it was 4,000. God was trying to get their attention, wasn't he? But, yeah, they just figured, well, we just got to get God on our side. You know, go grab the ark. So the ark, all it was a piece of furniture. And so they were treating it like a good luck charm. That's all it was, right? And so now they're really defeated. And that's what I'm saying. We lost 3,000 people on 9/11. We're losing people almost every day now in Afghanistan and Iraq. All right? But that's just the tip of the iceberg. What's coming next is going to be 9/11 times 10, times 100, times 1,000, times 10,000. You know, and call me the biggest pessimist this side of the Mississippi. I don't care because I'm telling you that's what's going to happen. And I don't claim to be a prophet. I'm just reading what God has said over and over and over again. You can see it. You can see it in the warning. And we can see it tonight. These people, they should, instead of repenting, instead of seeking God's face, instead of turning from their wicked ways, instead of humbling themselves before Him, they just figure, we'll get God on our side. We'll go back into battle. And God is far, far more concerned about vindicating His holiness than He is His power. He really is. All right? And we're going to see that in a minute here, because it says here in verse 11, and the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. Now, they met their judgment. And they brought this tremendous judgment. And it was all brought upon Israel because, in my opinion, because of Eli. What was Eli's weakness? He was a gluttonous man. And so when his sons picked up this gluttony in their own life, he was in no position to rebuke them. You notice how quickly he was to rebuke Hannah? Remember when he thought she was drunk and she was praying there before the Lord in the temple? Her lips were moving, but nothing was coming out of her mouth because she was praying from her heart. Eli said, hey, how long are you going to be, you know, acting like a drunken bum here, man? Put that, you know, liquor away from you. And she just said, no, I'm not drunk. I'm just pouring my heart out to God. But you see, he just jumped on her case. He had no problem in doing it to a total stranger, but he couldn't do it to his sons because I think he was in no position to and he knew it. So what I'm saying is, because of one man's gluttony, look at the end result. One man's sin, one man's weakness. The man was very important. The man was in a very, very crucial position as high priest. And so his sin had a much more devastating effect, obviously. And it had a tremendous effect upon the whole nation. So then what happens is when Eli hears the news about the ark, it says that he fell over backwards. That's why I say you got to put this together as little pieces. And you begin to see, I think, a glimpse of what really transpired here. This is what we read here. The guy was 98 years old and heavy. The Holy Spirit put that in there for a reason. So you get the impression that, okay, he was a gluttonous man, and you know that his sons were because of the way they treated the sacrifices. And anyway, Phinehas' wife gives birth, and she dies in childbirth. She says, they named the kid Ichabod, which means no glory, or glory has departed. And once God has departed, I mean, I'll give you an example, and then we're going to move on. But you know I use this a lot, but gosh, it's so, to me, it's so glaring as far as it being an example. Go back to 1963, and we're talking 40-something years ago when this worthless, good-for-nothing, wicked woman got God thrown out of her schools in 1963, right? Madeline Marie O'Hare. Her and a bunch of worthless judges and lawyers got God kicked out, all right? Before that, our educational institutions were the glory of the world. Oh, what I mean by the glory of the world, I mean they were the envy of the world, weren't they? They were the envy of the world. We were first in everything. You know, I don't care whether it's the sciences or whether it was biology or whatever it was, we were leading the world in education 45 years ago. Now look at us. We have become so dumbed down. There's no glory. The glory has departed. Why? Because God's departed. See what I'm saying? That's just one tiny example, but you can use all kinds of other examples of how the glory has departed from this country because we have forsaken God. Anybody have anyone to add or share to that chapter? Well, listen, we still have, I think, about 15 minutes, if I'm not mistaken, and this is only 12 verses. So let's just quickly read this chapter 5, and then we'll go ahead and close for tonight. It says in verse 1 in chapter 5, it says, "Now the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it to Ebenezer to Ashdod." From Ebenezer to Ashdod, excuse me. "Then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. When the Ashdodites arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the Ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and set him in his place again. And when they arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the Ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were cut off on the threshold, and only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. Therefore, neither the priest of Dagon nor all who enter Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. Now the hand of the Lord was heavy upon the Ashdodites, and he ravaged them and smote them with hemorrhoids." Now, I think most Bibles say either tumors or boils. I mean, anybody's Bible say tumors or boils? Mm-hmm. What does yours say?
Tumors.
Okay, yours says tumors. Okay, let me just read this from verse 6 again. It says, "Then the hand of the Lord was heavy upon the Ashdodites, and he ravaged them and smote them with the hemorrhoids, both the Ashdod and his territories. And when the men of Ashdod saw that it was so, they said, 'The Ark of God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is severe upon us and on Dagon our God.' And so they sent and gathered all the lords of the Philistines to them and said, 'What shall we do with the Ark of the God of Israel?' And they said, 'Let the Ark of God of Israel be brought around to Gath.' So they brought the Ark of God of Israel around. And it came about that after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city with very great confusion. And he smote the men of the city, both young and old, so that the hemorrhoids broke out upon them." Are really literally tumors or boils. In verse 10, "So they sent the Ark of God to Ekron. And it happened as the Ark of God came to Ekron that the Ekronites cried out and saying, 'They have brought the Ark of God of Israel round to us to kill us and our people.' They sent therefore and gathered all the lords of the Philistines and said, 'Send away the Ark of the God of Israel and let it return to its own place, that it may not kill us and our people. For there was a deadly confusion throughout the city, and the hand of God was very heavy there. And the men who did not die were smitten with hemorrhoids, and the cry of the city went up to heaven." Okay, God allowed his ark to be taken, all right? And, of course, you know, people all throughout history have felt like, hey, the God with the greatest strength is going to be the God who gives victory in war. And if you are defeated in battle, it means your God was not strong enough against your enemy's gods. So, but God doesn't care about that. He's not concerned about manifesting his power. What he's really concerned about is his holiness. So God lets his ark be stolen because his people had basically forsaken him and forgotten him. So he just leaves them in a sense. But God can take care of himself because they put this ark in the temple of Dagon. Now, I've read different things about Dagon. And I think this statue, it looked like half fish, half man. It had the upper torso and the head of a man, and it had from the waist down, it had the body of a fish. At least that's one thing I read about Dagon. Another attribute about Dagon was that he was supposed to be a god that was supposed to be in control of your crops and to make sure that he was a god they appealed to for an abundance as far as, their wheat fields and their grain fields and their barley fields and this type of thing. But I think it has more to do with this god man, Dagon. And interesting, they put the Ark of God before the statue. Almost, I guess, figuring that, well, Dagon is the one who gave us victory, and so he's the god who's over this god. But in the morning, the priests go in there, and the whole statue of Dagon has fallen down before the ark. And so what did these fools do? They set it back up in its place. Look at that verse 2. It says, Dagon had fallen to his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and set him in his place again. I mean, this is some god, isn't it? You know what I mean? Really. And then in verse 4 it says, and when they arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. So even though they set him up, the next morning, this thing had fallen down before the ark, and then it just shattered. The hands broke off, and the head broke off, and they rolled right up there to the threshold, where it's basically where the entranceway is to the door, the vestibule, the doorway there. And the head's sitting there, and the hands are sitting there. And it says here that from that day on, the priest of Dagon, every time they were going to go step into the temple of Dagon, they jump over the threshold because the hands of Dagon and his head were there, all right? And to me, that's pretty, I think, significant. What was God trying to show these people? That this God can neither see, nor hear, nor smell, nor think, nor do anything. That's why God just had the head and the hands roll right there at the doorway. And it was almost like God was rubbing their noses in it, because every time they entered the temple, they had to jump over the threshold, figuring, well, Dagon's hands and head were there, so we don't want to be sacrilegious and blaspheming by stepping on that place's heads were. Isn't it amazing how people can become so demented when it comes to, you know, setting up false gods and false idols? I mean, God was just rubbing their noses in it. And here you got a situation now where God is showing that, hey, I don't need any army. I don't need anyone to take care of myself. Because now he's smiting the entire Philistine city with boils or tumors. Now, I'm going to get into this in a lot more detail when we get into next week. Because what's happening now is they're sending this ark all around to different Philistine cities. And we're going to find out next week that for 7 months, this ark, it's like a hot potato. Nobody wants it, because everywhere it goes, it brings a curse on the people. And this is a situation where it's, even though my Bible says hemorrhoids, and I think other Bibles say hemorrhoids, I know the King James says it, what it really is, I think that the word can be translated tumors or boils or hemorrhoids. But nobody really dies of hemorrhoids, right? And it says here that people were dying from what was happening. Now, when we get into next week, we're going to find out that there was another element to this plague. All right? And the element to this plague, the other element to this plague, were mice. And I really think what's happening here is that these people are experiencing a plague very, very similar to the bubonic plague. Because people are dying and they're coming down with these tumors or these boils. I know that when they had the Black Plague in Europe and in the Isles and other places, I mean, they call it the Black Death because people ended up with black splotches all over their bodies. But I'll get into that next week. But I'm just saying that, and setting the stage here, is that, you know, God's smiting these people with this terrible affliction. And they're beginning to sense, hey, this is supernatural in nature. And everywhere this ark goes, it's nothing but bad news. So they've got this ark for 7 months. We're going to read that next week before they finally come to their senses and say, man, we got to get rid of this thing. All right? But anyway, does anybody want to add or share to what we read tonight? Because I know we're out of time. But I'm going to deal with this much more fully next week when we get into chapter 6 and chapter 7. As a matter of fact, I'll kind of give a review on chapter 5. Because I think it's a fascinating story, what happens here. Anybody have anyone to add or share?
Was Eli in control of the ark when they went to Shiloh to get
it? No, because Eli was 98 years old. He was blind. He couldn't go anywhere. Okay, but he sent his sons in with the ark to carry the ark into battle. You see?
So, I mean, who was in control of the ark, though?
His sons? It's his sons. You know, Hophni and Phinehas. They were the ones who were carrying the ark into battle, and they were the ones who were killed. And that's when the light of Eli's priesthood begins to go out. But I'll get into that a little bit more next week, too, because even though more of Eli's descendants will continue to function as a priest, this is the beginning and the end of their dynasty. And when Solomon comes along, he's the one that will change this whole priestly dynasty over to Zadok. And we'll read about that later when we get into Kings. And what's interesting to me is that you read the book of Ezekiel, and we will find out that during the millennial period, when Christ sets up his millennial temple, the descendants of Zadok are going to be acting as priests during the millennial period. You know, so I'm telling you, Eli's sin had a tremendous, far-reaching consequence, not just upon himself, but upon his sons and upon the nation. And it's even going to be carried into the millennial period in the sense that his descendants will no longer have that privilege. And the man of God, the prophet of God that was sent to Eli, told him that, hey, everyone in your household is going to die in their prime. You know, nobody's going to live to an old age because of one man's sin. Anyone else have anyone to share?